This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to be here with you in Zazenkai. I'd like to begin with a poem someone sent me from Thomas Merton. It's called In Silence. Be still. Listen to the stones of the wall. Be silent. They try to speak your name. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Who are you? Whose silence are you? Who? Be quiet. Are you as these stones are quiet? Do not think of what you are, still less of what you may be one day. Rather, be what you are. But who? Be the unthinkable one you do not know. Oh, be still while you are still alive, and all things live around you speaking. I do not hear to your own being, speaking by the unknown that is you and in themselves. I will try, like them, to be my own silence, and this is difficult. The whole world is secretly on fire. The stones burn, even the stones, they burn me. How can a person be still or listen to all things burning? How can they dare to sit with them when all their silence is on fire? So every day I renew my vows to point me in the direction of why I do this. The whole world is secretly on fire. Stones burn, even the stones, they burn me. How can a person be still or listen to all things burning? How can they dare to sit with them when all their silence is on fire? And this question of, does this work? Does practice work? I think comes up for a lot of us because of this intimate language with things and this unknowing that we're placed into. Listening to silence speak, we take the backward step in a world of impermanence and uncertainty. Of course, this isn't news, new news, that this is how it is. Maybe on an emotional level, it's getting closer, it's getting more real that this is true. It's easy to, I can pull anyone in here off the street and say, hey, do you know things don't last and things change? Yeah. Of course. But to really like be in that is a burning thing. It's impossible to ignore. So this question of, so to really address this question, this beautiful question, and answer it with our body-mind, does practice work? We engage our life with empathy, with integrity, and as practitioners, we practice the paramitas, our virtues, we cultivate our compassion, our giving, our effort, our morality, our energy, our clear seeing, our trust, and perhaps most of all, our courage. Be what you are, but who? Be the unthinkable one you do not know. And David White has this beautiful piece he wrote on the ability to ask beautiful questions. I don't know if you've read it, but he says, the ability to ask you beautiful questions is often very unbeautiful in very unbeautiful moments is one of the greatest disciplines of human life. And a beautiful question starts to shape your identity as much as by asking it, and it does by having it answered. You just have to keep asking, and before you know it, you will find yourself actually shaping a different life, meeting different people, finding conversations that are leading you in those directions that you wouldn't even have seen before. So I think this question of why, of does practice work, is important for many reasons, but two is first that we can get lost when our initial impulse to do it gets muddy, when that original spark of why we came, why we embark on the first place, gets lost in form or shoulds. So we need to then redirect ourselves to make contact again with that inner spark and radiance that brought us. Another important question from another point of view is, a new spark may have ignited, a lot of fire here, and we may not be aware of it yet. We may still be clinging to an old way or an old habit, like we cling to old relationships past their time, and that new spark that ignited that we're not aware of, by this clinging, we might be no longer, that thing fulfills what it used to fulfill. So to ask this question from time to time can be helpful. As I mentioned in Fusatsu, where I was looking at intention, I always like to remember I'm here by choice, that I wasn't wrapped up and brought in here to do Zazenkai, that we all walked in here because we made a choice. We entered practice by choice, coming from our heart's intention. So we're not here by our family or our inheritance or institutions, or because we're here because of ourselves. And we begin practice by choice, and we continue because we choose to. And we begin with this beautiful question, perhaps, in some way. So for some, it's very, very there as a sentence. This is why I came to this. For some of us, it's a body-mind feeling experience. A lot of ways to ask a question. Doesn't have to be a mental formation, an inquiry, a wonder, a quest. And perhaps the fruits of these inquiries will be of no interest, but if and when they are, then the next step is to explore them through practice. And we explore and follow the desire to practice. And perhaps we can recognize and reclaim that this is coming from our deep contact within the fire in silence. A spark of light from the silent reply to the inquiry, does this work? So we sit into that question and it's happening. The silent reply that we hear speaking. And then to explore and see what the exploration brings up. If the exploration is sustained, if we keep going, then we need to make a commitment. Uh-oh. That's where it gets a little rocky. Because commitment to such a deep exploration is necessary at some point. I think so. You know, I read Jack Kornfield in his book, one of his books, A Path with Heart. He said, somebody asked him, like, I do this, I do this, I do this. Is that okay? And he says, well, you can dig a lot of little holes, but eventually you got to dig a well. And this resonated with this email I got from this woman who, just to hear her, she had multiple practices. She was asking a question now, like what's working. She writes, I am aware of the multitude of spiritual practices available, and I'm curious about which is correct for me. I understand that ultimately all forms of practice are just forms, but I also understand, by the way, there's no periods here, but I also understand on the level of forms, forms are significant even though they are limited. I've come upon a practice that seems to really work, but it is very complicated. There are hundreds of visualization meditations that one progresses through. After practice that also works for me is simply the third eye meditation. Just focusing on and surrendering on my third eye and practicing pranayama along with the philosophy of kundalini, according to my third eye pranayama teacher, I should only focus on my third eye and on the static high-pitched sound. But according to the other teacher and teaching, I practice activating my chakras, including the center of the earth, my physical body's other chakras, and chakras above my crown. My questions are these. Could it be damaging to practice multiple practices? 2, the third eye meditation is so simple. Do this pranayama, awaken kundalini, listen to sound, but the other practice involves imagination and colors, activating chakras, and bilocating and accessing past lives. So maybe the third eye meditation is more passive and the other's more assertive. 3, each teacher tells me their way is best. Confusing all of this. Do these questions make sense? Where do I place my faith? I had to respond to her. So, if we are to commit to practice, what is the basis for the commitment? And I was remembering this book called Just Buddha by Karen Armstrong, which I really liked. And she makes it abundantly clear, I think, in this passage, Does It Work?, which she says was the basis for the Buddha's exploration into the essence of reality, which led him to his great enlightenment experience. That's what he was testing, all these practices. Does this work? She writes, a person's theology was a matter of total indifference to the Buddha. To accept the doctrine on a somebody else's authority was in his eyes an unskillful state, which could not lead to enlightenment because it was an abdication of personal responsibility. He saw no virtue to submitting to an official creed. Faith meant trust that nirvana, the extinguishing of a separate, distinct self, existed, and a determination to prove it to oneself. The Buddha always insisted that his disciple test everything he taught them against his own experience and take nothing on hearsay. A religious idea could all too easily become a mental idol, one more thing to cling when the purpose of the Dharma was to help people release, help us to see clearly our life. He said even his own teachings must be jettisons once they have done their job. And I remember my teacher used to say, no Buddhism, no ism. You know, what's in you? What's working for you? That's what you will be left with in your life. But yet we need a path. And this is all Shakyamuni Buddha was interested in. Does it work? And above all, does it work for me, for you? And this is what he said we ought to be interested in. This is the pragmatic basis of our exploration in Zen. This is the basis, in a sense, of Zen practice. And it's not kind of like, does it work as a measurement, but I'll get into that. So I've called this in other aspects of my life, as some of you know, maybe some of you women, I've spoke about it as desire research or pleasure research, in the sense of what kind of radiance do I have entering into the unknown, into not knowing, into what's not graspable. Yet the unmistakable, intelligent energy that has taken place, to recognize that. So I don't know, and yet I'm trusting the intelligence of something taking place that I don't know about, as I affirm with my practice. And I describe this not knowing as a flash of openness or a shift to being now, right here now, and the dropping away of things that I've relied on for stability, just being more uncertain, resting more in uncertainty as a real true thing of how things are. As a researcher, which we all are, as an explorer, which we all are, we know we have to continue our exploration when we get a glimpse of something we've never seen before. That's how it works. This is how we do it in our practice, in life. That's how we know when we are to continue. When we get a glimpse of something we haven't seen before, we know to continue, especially if it's helping us to see clearly our life, helping us to release, find happiness, true happiness, joy, a measure of joy. Even if it's, I say, in the middle of grief or depression, to be able to see in that clearly, there's a slight joy. There's a joy in there. We can make it contact with it. And so I'm not saying like we're going to be dancing around. We might be, but there will be a spark of contact with what is real and true if we can allow for all that we're experiencing to be there. We know it is necessary for us to continue when we see and we realize that we have seen something we've never seen or realized before. And that tool for that is our awareness. Awareness is the tool. Awareness of what is going on now. Right now. Like right now, for now. The makeup of our present experience. This is how we know we are to continue. Experiential awareness, we've heard this a lot, direct experience is how we prove it to ourselves by our direct experience. And that was the first day I received instruction on Zazen. I remember it was from Shugen Roshi now, who was a monk. And towards the end of the introduction to Zazen, he said, no one's going to give you anything. This is about direct personal experience. And I remember my whole body just felt like a release, a relief at that statement. And so I verified something in that moment. I remember feeling that release of like something was true in what was just said. I don't know what it is. And I kind of don't like that either. I wish somebody would tell me what to do and make it sort of laid out for me. So it was a double sword in a way. But ultimately, I knew that I would only rely on something. I knew that much, that it would come through my body and mind. So something was taking place all along in our lives, which meant most of us, that when we come to Zen, we already feel and know there's a resonance, something that we're hearing in the teachings is already in our body, is on fire. So how do we know this? Well, that it's working. Well, we can look at the makeup of our view, our worldview, our inner view. Am I able to see this person, this situation in a broader way, where maybe before I couldn't? Am I moving through this crisis with astonishing calmness? I should be freaking out. Did you ever say that to yourself? Every time I did this before, I was freaking out. How come I'm not freaking out? Huh? Isn't that curious? Like maybe something I'm doing is working. What have I been doing? Practicing something? I don't know. Am I able to be more open to owning the dark side of myself as it arises in my zazen? The dark part, the creepiness. Can I do that in my life, my interactions with people, except they have it too? Am I able to be more with my compulsions, my cravings, my needs, my bad feelings? You can fill it in. Am I present now? Is my universe expanding or is it contracting more? Am I facing suffering? This is what Merton speaks about. The whole world is secretly on fire. The stones burn, even the stones, they burn me. How can a person be still or listen to all the things burning? What do you hear in that? Avalokiteshvara, the one who hears the cries, the one who hears all the burning. That's us, both within and out. How do we sit in that royal ease? With our legs open, receiving our own cries, the cries of the world. This is how we know if what we are engaging works or not. And of course, this question, as I said before, does it work or not, is a whole body mind experience, as Dogen would say. He doesn't have them as two separate events, body, mind, whole body mind experience. So we often cannot go to the mind for our answers. That's the hard part. That's what koan study interrupts, that we can't go to the mind. We don't ignore it, but it doesn't work in the way that we usually try and figure things out. We have to, with a whole body mind experience, what the situation is. It's a lower down embodiment to every beautiful nerve ending. We have to listen so deeply. And this is why we need the silence, to hear this mystical language, this very intimate language that's happening, not through the mind. I remember somebody said, sorry I say this again in a lot of talks, but going to our mind to find all the answers, someone wrote, is like a corrupt police department trying to investigate itself. Can't do it. So sometimes the mind is corrupt, you know, it just doesn't know. It has information, but it doesn't know these deeper koans of our life that our whole body and mind are embedded in. And that requires this silence, this stillness, so we can hear the stones, the sky, the floor, our pores in their own language speaking, which our head does not figure out. The mind can't give us an answer because the mind always uses an outer yardstick. The mind's the last one to know. I feel like, God, my body is so way ahead sometimes. It's like if I just settle into my body, this will like get it, you know? That's why they work together. So that's why we be still, because the mind is like a racehorse. And, you know, it's the way they call it, untamed, monkey. Why do they use these things? You know, a monkey mind. It swings from vine to vine to vine to vine to vine. Loves to play and have fun and trickster and all those, you know, monkey things. Monkey around. So we go to only not mind part, not knowing, our inner sense, our inner connection, our inner treasure knows if it works. I often find that from people so much where they're saying to me, I don't know if I continue. And then there they are sitting again. I sit every day. And then their head's just telling me this whole other story. But they sit every day. I'm like, listen to yourself. Listen to your body, what it's doing as you goes to your cushion every time. Yeah. So we must expand our not knowing mind. That's what we're doing in a way. Lower it into our embodiment. Because as long as we try to grasp with our mind, it won't work. It has its limitations. So Zazen, above all, it's Zazen. Not the Buddha, not the teacher, not this talk, not the Sangha, not Zen. It's not anything. It's our individual practice of, as Dogen said, and I read this morning, thinking, non-thinking, carried out in our commitment to the practice of Zazen and our commitment to seeing this as very urgent and important. We need, yes, for sure, we need teachings, no doubt about it. We need Sangha. We need community. We need connection. We need all the skillful means that are necessary to get us going and keep us going and keep us from falling into delusion. We need each other for that and the teachings. But it's Zazen. It's just sitting so we can practice Zazen. That's why we say it's the heart of the practice. It is the way. Dogen says the moment you sit, that is enlightenment. So we're looking for it, but there we are, like, doing it. So it's not the thing. We have a thing, an idea. There goes the head. Enlightenment, enlightenment, light. Meanwhile, the lights are on. The lights are on. What are you seeing? Like, relax. Relax into that natural state. And you'll see it. It's not anywhere. It's not anything. And the level of Zazen that our deepest self, our most honest self knows, is not a coasting Zazen, but a deep, committed, on the edge, whatever we are, Zazen. So if it's a busy mind Zazen and you're seeing it, I think some light's on. We can't stop it, but we can let it keep flowing. We can go back a bit and see it all just like a film reel, just playing itself out. That's the habit. That's such a relief. And so another piece from the Buddha that all says, the Buddha. The Dharma is essential. Yeah, I was talking to him last night. The Buddha hotline. He's on the phone. I was remembering just now in India. I came out of, we went to the Gandhi Museum, and we came out of, we all split up and went to different rooms at our own pace. And I walked out, and Shugen Roshi was on the phone. And I was like, I almost had a look on my face. I was like, what? Like, who are you talking? And he covered the mouthpiece and he went, it's Gandhi. And he goes, yeah, it's Gandhi. And I picked up the phone. It was a live talk from Gandhi. So it was Gandhi. We don't have that of the Buddha, though, on Vulture Peak. So I'm on friggin' Vulture Peak, Mount Kutukutra, unbelievable. Up there, right? It's shaped like the beak of a vulture. It's this outcrop of rocks. And there I am. And we got to sit. So this is like a major tourist place. And at this moment, we're up there. Nobody's there. Can you believe it? With the thousands of people that come there, we had half an hour to ourselves at sunset with nobody up there but a bunch of monkeys, actually. Monkeys. They were all around. And so we sat. We made offerings, and we just sat. And, you know, the feeling was there, like the rocks and the air there still contain the molecules, I'm sure, of the Buddha and his time there. So if you really listen, you can hear these sutras. You can feel these sutras in every particle. So she says, the Dharma is essentially a method, and it stands or falls not by its metaphysicality or acuity or its scientific accuracy, but by the extent to which it works. The truths claim to bring suffering to an end, not because people subscribe to a salvific creed or to certain beliefs, but because they adopt the Buddha's program, his path, as a way of life. Over the centuries, people have indeed found that this practice has brought them a measure of peace and insight. They have realized that by reaching beyond themselves to a reality that transcends their rational understanding, they become fully human. For the Buddha, this was a fact. His method worked. Does it work for you? When someone asked Thomas Merton which was his best book on spirituality he had written, you know, there's a lot of them, he said, if I had my way, I would burn the lot and simply write, be quiet and listen. Be still and know that thou art God. Be still and know that thou art the awakened one.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.